Welcome to the Authentic Persuasion Show, a place where business and thought leaders come to weigh in on important sales-related topics that you can use in your sales career and life. I'm your host, Jason Cutter. My mission is to get your help in changing sales from something prospects fear to an act of service they actually seek out and appreciate. Whether you're in sales, leading sales teams, or own a business, I hope this helps you improve your selling effectiveness and you can go out into the world as an authentic persuader. Hey, everybody. Welcome to another guest episode of the Authentic Persuasion Show. My special guest today is Kevin Jantz. I know I say this all the time. If you're a longtime listener of the show, I say that I'm excited every single time. But this is a new one for me. This is going to be a new type of guest in a new industry that I have yet to talk in meeting him. It's the first time I was even thinking about this. So Kevin spent 16 years on the buying side of government contracting as a contracting officer. And after watching so many companies struggle to thrive in what he refers to as GovCon, he realized he wasn't able to help them all on the buying side. And so in 2012, he left to found his company, who has a single focus of guiding people through selling to the government by understanding the market from the lens of the buyer, right? The contracting officer on the other side. He now provides GovCon training and consulting to government contractors across a variety of industries. Kevin, welcome to the Authentic Persuasion Show.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
So it's interesting because for myself, I have very limited experience. But I have been a government contractor, so not a contracting officer, not somebody involved with the contracting and the buying and the selling of things. I have been, I guess, one of those things that have been bought or sold as a government contractor and labor on a team, I mean, if we want to put it that way. And so it's interesting to think about the buying and selling part of it and what goes into that. So I'm super excited for this. This is going to be fun.
This will. We'll keep it to an hour if we can. There's a lot of stuff to cover and I try not to get too excited and talk too fast, but I find the puzzle of government contracting fascinating. So if I go down any rabbit trails, let me know.
Let's do it. So one of the things that's interesting is your journey. And you said this to me. And again, this is another one of these firsts. Like I'd never heard this term. Is you essentially started your life career B2C and then B2B and then B2G, right? Business to government. So explain, I guess, where you started that transition, how the transitions have gone. Ultimately, what I want to know is like what applies, what can people take from what works over here and works B2G, what doesn't work. So let's run with that.
Okay. My very first sales job was like a lot of folks. I was actually selling door-to-door magazine subscriptions of all things. And at the time, I'm realizing what a B2C sale is, right? Well, then I went to telemarketing when I was in college. And the idea of a B2C sale, business to consumer, is you get in front of them once. You need to, like a car salesman, I need to sell it to them before they leave the lot, right? That idea of this is the basic opportunity is now. That's a B2C structure because they're going to buy it somewhere else. It's a consumer has a need. Well, then I get introduced to this quasi version of B2B, business to business sales. Again, I was in college and I found sales jobs to be, I was making $1,200 a week selling cookbooks door to door, which as a college student, that's really good money back in the 90s. And so I thought this sales thing's really working. But what I was doing is I was going from business to business, dropping off a cookbook. And it was a company called American Book Display. We display the books. And then the business model is the people who work in the business, like a hair salon or an auto body shop or whatever, they would have the books laid out. And then either their customers or their employees would buy the book. And I learned about things like target marketing, because there's a reason we sold a cookbook. A Stephen King book is only going to be interesting to a few people. Cookbooks are broadly valuable. The fact that people want to see a physical cookbook, and it was a thick one, it had lots of different things in it. So it was a target marketing strategy of, we know the average person that walks by, if they're going to buy a book, it's going to be a cookbook, potentially. It's a great gift, et cetera, et cetera. It was a B2B sale because I was actually selling the business on allowing us to leave it at their business. And then they would effectively sell it on our behalf, right? And I would come back once a week and I would deliver X number of cookbooks that were sold, and I would collect the revenue, the checks from them, and then I would keep a share of that, right? And so it got me in this hybrid of they were making the B2C sale. Again, I didn't know what B2B and B2C were at that point, right? Well, then I go through college, and I actually got a really cool job working for the government where I was a contracting officer buying stuff. So I went from being a sales, and I still had my part-time jobs. I liked the model of selling, had my own businesses, so I was still doing some selling, but I was learning how to be a professional buyer. And I realized that for the first time, the difference between a B2C and a B2B sale is the complexity. Is it's more than one person is making the decision. the sale is broken into pieces. You have things like, does the customer want it? Yes. Does the customer have the ability to buy it? I don't know. That might be different. Like the person that comes into the car dealership and wants the Ferrari, that's nice. But if they're somebody's kid and they don't have the money to write the check, it's not going to close, right? Well, that's how the business sale worked. I started to realize that companies would come to us and say, hey, Mr. Contracting Officer, I want to buy this from you. Let me give you your first foray into how government contracting works. There are actually three deciders in government contracting. And you'll notice this is similar for business to business as well. The three deciders is the person who has the money. We call that the economic decider. Then there's the person who has the need. We call that the user or the customer. Then there's the person that actually has the ability to facilitate the sale. In business to business, that is usually the procurement division, and their procurement office, right? The person that at the end actually gets the contract signed. In government contracting, that's the contracting officer. And so if you try to sell to the contracting officer, they don't have any money. That's what the economic decider has. They don't have the actual need. That's actually what the user or the customer has. So that's why it's a complex sale. Most of the time when you're making a business to consumer sale, like when I was trying to sell somebody on a magazine subscription, the person on the phone is the economic decider. They got the money. They're the user. They want the magazine. And they're the procurement person because they have the ability to say yes and give me their credit card. So in a consumer sale, it's usually the same people. But in business to business and also in business to government, you've got these different players. And so going back to your question, what's the same and what's different? Well, business to government, like I said, is similar to business to business in terms of you have those three deciders. You have the economic decider, you have the user or customer, the person that needs the product or service, and then you have the contracting officer. Here's what's really different in the government market. The contracting officer doesn't work for the other two. Why is that important? Sometimes I've sold to like Fortune 100 companies. I mean, our target market is companies that have more than five employees, like five to 100 employees or over 1,000 employees. So sometimes I've got a small business and sometimes I've got a huge company that we're going with. On those huge companies, the person who is the procurement office, they usually work for somebody in like the CFO, or they work for somebody in one of those two other groups, the economic decider or the user. They work for one of those. So what does that mean? That means by the time the deal has gotten to them, it's not a matter of if they're going to buy from us, it's how. It's how are we going to get this done? They're going to work their way through how exactly is the acquisition going to get done? Well, if you're the procurement office, they have templates, they have processes, they're just going to get it in place. It will get done. On the government side, the contracting officer is, I'll be melodramatic and say handcuffed in some ways by, as you can imagine, regulations, rules, policies, etc. One of the big ones is called the Federal Acquisition Regulation. And it has all kinds of rules about who you can award to, whether or not you have to compete a contract, how often you can compete the contract. There's an entire section of the regulation that talks about whether or not, not if and how, but whether or not you can give a contract directly to someone else without competing it. What does that mean? Well, that means now, instead of in the B2B space, where when you get to the procurement office, they've pretty much decided they can give you the contract. It's just a matter of working out the details. So you might be 90% of the way to the sale. On the government side, you might be 50%. Because when the economic decider says, yes, I want you to buy this product, and the user says, yes, I need that product, and they take that to the contracting officer, and it's the first time I've seen it, and I go, well, this is a foreign company. This needs to be awarded under this contract type. They don't have the ability to do cost type contracts. They're not on this contract vehicle. They've been debarred. All of these things have happened where they come to me saying, go buy this. I'm like, I legally can't. Or I can't do it in the way that you'd like me to do it. So we have to go around this path. We have to compete it. We have to justify why we're not competing it. All of those things come into play that simply don't exist on the B2B space. And so it's like different in a small way, but it's enough that it literally becomes a roadblock when you go to close the deal. And all of a sudden, as a contracting officer, you just run into me and I literally can't give you the contract. Did that help?
Yes.
That's a long answer.
But running with that, because there's a lot we can unpack in reverse. So if somebody is selling to government, wanting to sell to the government, have the government as a client, let's say, and this is going to be similar to the B2B side, then who should they start with? Or how do they approach keeping in mind those three members? Because I've actually seen this firsthand, keeping in mind what the contracting officer, the procurement person, the CFO in a private organization, whoever's doing that final financial decision side, Where do you start? What's the best way to approach that government entity if you get two yeses and a no?
So the great news is there are lots of ways to sell to the government. I think the simplest metaphor is the stock market. When we say the market is up because the Dow is up, well, the Dow is only 30 companies. It's a small portion, right? And so same thing, the government market is huge. It's not one big entity. It's lots of small entities. Yes, the overall federal budget is passed. But for example, the National Defense Authorization Act is only the DOD budget. Granted, it's huge and it covers a whole lot of stuff and it's one of the bigger ones, but it's still only one part. The first thing to figure out is who actually buys what I sell. Before you even approach the government market, how does the government buy this? So for example, if you have cybersecurity professional services, I can tell you like 10 different ways the government buys. Figuring out how the government buys from you. And the cool part about the government market, there's lots of business intelligence that's available for free. That's something I thought everybody knew, like the amount of business intelligence. I'm going to give you a couple of websites. USAspending.gov has a huge, like trillions of dollars that is spent over the last 15 years in every nook and cranny of the government you could think of. If it's not classified and it's over $25,000, it's pretty much guaranteed to be on that. So whatever your, again, I'm using government terms, North American Industrial Classification System code, your NAICS code, specifies what you do. Like if you're professional services, it's probably like 541611. It's a 6-digit code. So you go looking for all of the contracts awarded under that NAICS code. And this is a free website. USAspending.gov is free. And it will show you who the agencies are, how much the contracts were worth, when they were awarded. And you can see, okay, they buy what I sell. That's the first place to figure out, does the agency even buy what I sell? So once you've answered that question, then you've got at least three entry points. Actually, I'll go with four. The first one is low hanging fruit, is what's called the government credit card. And there are thresholds for these, which makes it really easy to imagine. So the government credit card, the government can, and this is a contracting officer or a government employee with a government credit card. It doesn't even have to be a contracting officer. It could be that user you're talking to. If your product is under $10,000 and they have a government credit card, they can just buy it from you on the spot. It's a commercial transaction. There's no small business rules. Literally they can walk into the local award, a place that makes trophies, and they're buying trophies. They literally use that government credit card and they just buy from whoever they want because it's open market. Okay. So under $10,000, that's one place to live. The next place to live, if you're a small business, is $10,000 to $250,000. Or here's the fun part. If it's a commercial item, up to $7.5 million. Now we're talking real money, right? The beauty of the simplified acquisition procedures, which is what I'm talking about, that's that group set aside exclusively for small businesses. And definition of small business is going to depend on that NAICS code I mentioned. So for example, the 614611, as of recently, it's $15 million a year. And the last average of your last 3 years can't be more than $15 million. So it's not a tiny company. It's a small business by the standard, right? So if you meet under that standard, you're considered a small business, which means all those contracts that are between 100,000 and 250K or up to 7.5 million to simplified acquisition procedures. In this case, the contracting officer is a good person to talk to because what they're going to do is get three quotes and pick the best one. They're getting input from the economic decider. They're getting input from the actual user. But now if you've got two out of three, and if the economic decider says, yes, I want this, and the user says, yes, I want this, now the question is, how do you get it? Well, if you're a small business and you've got under $15 million in revenue, you tell the economic decider, use simplified acquisition procedures. And that way there's only three people competing for this. And we're the lead horse in the race because you know we can do it. That's not even necessarily required to be competed on the public market. Accounting officer can literally collect three proposals that they just ask for and then say, you know what, this is the best one and off you go. And so that's the second group. The third group, which is the one that makes the news and is actually the hardest to get into, is the larger contracts. We call them contracts by negotiation. Those are the ones that are 250,000 up to billions. And the bigger they get, the more players are involved, the more approvals are involved, the more steps are involved. If you're not in the government market, that is not where you should start. Unless, and here's the fourth way to do it, as a subcontractor. If you know that the government buys what you sell, and you know how they buy it is this big contract that some other company like a Booz Allen Hamilton, let's just say they're the prime contractor, right? And you know that they want it and they're probably going to be competing for it again. For you to go up against them, good luck. The better strategy is bring yourself to the table based on your expertise and your background. And by the way, you're a small business. Don't start with that, but include that in the conversation to get yourself in as a subcontractor. that will be the path of least resistance on a larger contract. But if you're looking to just enter the market and you've got a product under 10K or under 250K and you know how to build relationships, in other words, you know how to sell, that sale is going to feel a lot like a B2B sale. It gets to be really B2G-like when you get above $250,000. And that line can make things really frustrating because it feels completely different when you get above 250K.
And what's interesting about all that is I agree with you, which is the headlines and the thoughts of, okay, well, there's going to be this long process. I've got to submit to the government, because what you don't see in the headline is the $8,000 purchase on the government credit card, right? What you see is correct. The deal with Lockheed Martin to make these jets for the government, and it's this many billion dollars. And it's like, oh my gosh, like that seems so confusing. And I have been on projects as an employee working for a government contracting research engineering agency, right? A couple of times, companies, even as a big company, they're a subcontractor under somebody else who had the ability to win the contract because they were even bigger. And so this big company was a sub. And then I've also been a part of it where the big companies all lost to a small minority woman-owned business that was then the prime contract. And then they brought in all the big companies to do the work underneath because they won the right to that. So I think that's what's overwhelming for a lot of people who are thinking that. Like, I'm thinking for myself, it's like, this would be a great avenue, but I can't compete. But what you're telling me is like, you just got to find your way.
And find your niche. Yeah. And for example, I didn't get into the small business set-asides of women-owned, veteran-owned, hub zone, which stands for historically underutilized business zone. And we have podcast episodes about all of these on our podcast. But the idea of knowing which one of those niches you fall into, and it's interesting, you said that the beauty of the competitive process is what you just said a minute ago, is that the large business is lost to a small business. Yeah. And it's a fun way to think through that, because technically they could have lost to a small business. Like, what's called a full and open competition means anybody can bid on it. Usually the large businesses are going to be the first ones to go after those big ones, but small businesses win them once in a while. What actually could have happened is that this women-owned small business convinced the government to set it aside as a women-owned small business competition, which means they only have to have two companies that they know can do it. And that's a key factor. It's not the existence of two companies. It's two that have some past performance and can actually do the work. And then they build a team. And a lot of times we'll help our clients go through the process of, this is an opportunity that I can win as a small business, but it's a $50 million contract and I'm a $6 million a year business. I got to have large business partners that have scaled before to convince the government that when my business goes from 6 million to 60 million in 4 years, I'm going to be able to handle it. And so the teaming goes both ways. The subcontracting eventually flips over where you as a small business, like ones that have 13 million a year in revenue, they're subbing to large businesses because they need that footprint. And so there's a lot of nuance to this. And the best way to not get frustrated is figure out, what's my entry point? If your entry point is the large ones, then you're going to start with that sub piece and you'll learn more about how effectively to use the subcontracting elements.
Got it. So let's talk about the selling part. Again, you come from just selling magazines, cookbooks, to selling businesses to business, then into business to government, right? And then actually now you're B2B because your company is now helping companies as their your clients, right? Into those, right? So you've kind of gone this like weird evolutionary path.
Exactly.
Next thing is some kind of consumer product that you're selling, maybe books or magazines again. That would be a funny full circle. So from a sales, like a selling, sales, persuasion, kind of conversational, like what works well in these B2G conversations you're having both with the economic buyer, the user of whatever it is that you're providing, the contracting officer? What are some sales fundamentals that you found still work? Which ones don't work, right, in that B2G sale, if you will?
So the biggest thing is, just like in B2B, having an understanding of what problem are you solving for them. If you lead with the fact that, here's what does not work. If you lead with the fact that, hey, I'm a women-owned small business, where's my contract? I've actually gotten that phone call before. Or, hey, I'm a veteran-owned small business, where's my contract? That is not what to lead with, okay? Lead with this idea of, what problem do you actually solve? And that's back to the targeting. That is the same for B2B. We call it the first half of the sale for business to government is going to feel a lot like business to business. It's targeting, it's relationship building, it's figuring out who at the agency cares about what you do. It's figuring out who's the incumbent. Is there an incumbent? It's getting them to understand that this is a solution that they need. it's not different, can be frustrating in that the government tends to be more requirements-based versus solutions-based. And so going back to what works in B2B versus B2C, in a business-to-business sale, if you show me something I've never heard of before, but you can show me that it's going to save us $50,000 a year and it costs $5,000, or $5 million a year and it costs $50,000, the fact that I've never heard of it before doesn't matter. You show me the evidence, this is a better way to live. I can go in that direction and buy from you guys. In the government market, if I don't have a requirement as a contracting officer, it's really hard for me to award a contract because the requirement has to come before the funding. There's all kinds of rules about how this happens, but the government has to have the requirement before they can allocate our tax dollars, appropriated funds, to solve the problem. So if you have a really innovative solution that the government's never bought before, they don't have a requirement for it. Therefore, it's going to be harder for you to sell it to them. That's why a lot of startups and a lot of innovative solutions don't go to the government first, because the system's not built for that. The good news is there are little niches, like they call, like hero terms like AFWERX and other transaction authorities, which are niche projects. But for really high-end, unique things, you'll end up with, there are paths to get to. But back to the sales piece, who do you start with? You do not start with the contracting officer. You start with the people who have the need. Those are the people who are at the conferences, who are actively on LinkedIn looking for information. You're looking for titles like program manager, project manager, the acquisition executive, the people who are driving the requirement to be fulfilled. That's who you start with. The things not to do is spam the contracting officer. To build relationships with contracting officers is valuable at the right time. And the time to build a relationship with a contracting officer is either right before the RFP comes out, so they're expecting to see your proposal, during the performance of a contract is the best place. If you have a contract and you're performing on, that is the best time to build a relationship with a contracting officer, which you can then leverage later when you submit a proposal a year from now. They're going to know who you are. So that's one of the areas that I saw a few companies benefit from when I was a contracting officer, is they would spend the time to build a relationship with me as the business side of government contracting. The instinct is to build a relationship with the actual customer, the user, the person you're serving, the one you're providing the product or service to. But the advanced concept is build that relationship with a contracting officer during the contract performance. So just FYI, but back to the pre-award, the sales part. When you're actually in the fog of war, trying to pick these opportunities, starting with the contracting officer is going to be frustrating because they don't know why they should care. Okay. Again, it's classic B2B sales. Why do they care? Like, there's nothing in it for them to pay attention to you until they know that you can solve a problem for them. And so a person that might care is going to be someone that's called a small business specialist or a small business liaison officer or a small business director or director of small business programs, those kind of titles. Again, if you're a small business, this is a government person whose job it is to facilitate the government meeting their small business standards. This is one of the goals. There's a goal of 23% a year is how much is supposed to be awarded to small businesses. That's their win, is meeting that goal for their agency, for their office, for their division, whatever. The squirrely part is that sometimes that person's title is on LinkedIn. Other times it's not. And so a way to get an in with a contracting officer or to create a bump shot for a contracting officer is hit them out of the gate with, I know you don't buy what we sell. I know that this isn't something you can help with because it doesn't make sense for me to talk to you from a technical perspective, but can you tell me who the small business director is for your division? That person cares about. The contracting officer knows who that is. And the contracting officer's name is going to be public because every RFP that I ever posted, my name is on there. My contact information is easy to find. The trick is if you come to me with, where's my contract? It's a wasted exercise. Whereas if you come to me with something that I can hand off to somebody else, which what's in my best interest? Okay, yes, I want to help small businesses benefit, et cetera. But I can't be the only one that does it. This person, the small business specialist, is. So if you create a conversation that gets me to hand it off to somebody else, that's their job, that's actually a good strategy to use. And then another thing to do is just building this, we'll call it a repertoire of what kind of content do you have that they care about? What I mean by that, a capability statement is the standard language for that. But the problem with that is if you just make a capability statement that says it's all about you, it's on the pile of good ideas, you know, whatever. A better strategy is to build out a list of targeted capability statements. And don't even call it that. Just say, this is our overview. Because who wants to see that? Is that small business specialist, and then potentially the contracting officer for future reference. So the small business specialist is someone you really want to build a relationship with. Here's another cool part. Large businesses, like all the names that you know from the government market, a lot of them have what's called a small business liaison officer. And that is a person in their company whose job it is to make sure that they meet their subcontracting goals. Large businesses have subcontracting goals. There's a clause that says you have to make a subcontracting plan. And the amount of subcontracting you have to do is often specific to the opportunity. I've had RFPs that I put out where it was 35% of the work had to be subcontracted out. Wow. Well, the person that's responsible for that, that gets rewarded or beat upside the head for meeting that or not, is the small business liaison officer. There are lots of people, actually on Google, go to LinkedIn and search for that term, and you'll see lots of people that have that role. They are looking for small companies to team with. They are looking for companies that actually can do the work. Great people to be able to talk to about what kind of work is available in this agency versus that agency. So they're like the industry version of the small business specialist. So those are the entry points. And then the other one, which is the preferred one, but it's a lot harder to do sometimes, is find that end user. If you can find the end user that actually needs the software you have, needs the body armor you have, needs the vehicle you have, needs the facilities maintenance that you have, like the person that's responsible for the building, that's responsible for the program, that's the person that you want to get, we'll call it the understanding of the requirement from. But understand, they can't award you the contract. So don't lead them down that path that they're going to be able to say, yes, this is how we can buy from you. Because what'll happen, and I've laughed because this is how I figured out how we can actually help companies. One of our customers came to us, this is like 3 years ago. He said, I finally got the government to say yes. And then the government person said, okay, what's the next step? And of course, then the sales guy's like, well, I thought you knew. That finally taught me that's the gap that we fill. That's when you call us.
If there's one thing I know, it's that sales is full of failure. Even if you're a Hall of Fame level sales professional, you can make a great income despite losing more than you're winning. If there's one aspect of sales that most people fear and what keeps a lot of people even wanting to get into sales, it's getting hit with objections. That is why I wrote my latest book, The Sales Consultant Guide to Overcoming Objections, Yours and Theirs. This is the first in my new series of short books, guides filled with what you need for helping you improve your selling effectiveness. No fluff, no long-winded stories, no filler to make it seem more valuable, just actual foundation-building strategies to help you become aware of the true nature of why your prospects bring up objections, the different type of objections, and then specific ways to overcome them that are universal to most any sales process, product, service, or style. Go to Amazon.com today and get your copy of A Sales Consultant's Guide to Overcoming Objections. Or if you'd rather, as a gift to the listeners of this podcast, email me at jason@cutterconsultinggroup.com and I'll send you a complimentary full version of it as my thank you for listening and supporting this show. And that's perfect because, again, I'm thinking of my own experiences. A lot of my clients, most people maybe who are listening to this, they know that from a B2B side. I'm doubting there's too many people who are going from magazines to government contract. That's their target, but maybe they are. I'm not going to limit my audience and their aspirations, but most likely people are used to that in a B2B stance. And that's what happens a lot is I can almost always think of B2B sales. Let's say it's a software as a service and you're selling into a company and you have something that's a marketing automation platform. And unless you're going to the top, most people are going to that marketer, that CMO, that marketing manager, director of marketing, and saying, hey, we've got this thing, you should do it. They get all excited and go, okay, great. Now I just need to find the money and get approval and then get everyone on board. And it's like, oh crap. A lot of salespeople focus on that, which is good. Then you have to turn that person into the champion, and then they have to get the approval from above and the money from somebody else. And so obviously the better way to go is to go to the top, which is B2B, the person who's running or owns the business. If they're on board, then they can make sure the check gets written. However, it also doesn't work if the owner's on board, but the director of marketing is like, no, I don't want this. This isn't going to help. And then there's a disconnect, and I've seen deals fall apart there. So I love what you're talking about, which is just be careful, especially if you've got that end user at the government excited and they want it. Be aware that that means very little, right? I'm glad they're excited, but yeah, somebody's got to approve it and then somebody's got to pay for it.
Another big difference between even selling into a Fortune, like a large business that has their own procurement process, the difference between that kind of a sale and a government sale is that at the end of the day, even if it's publicly traded to some extent, the CEO owns the process. The leader of that organization owns it. So it'll get to the point, like if Jeff Bezos wants to buy from this company, it's going to happen. Right. Whereas in the government space, the process is owned by federal law. And so a lot of times you'll run into these, what seem like nonsensical solutions of like, why can't I just buy this from this company? And there's some nuance of how the process was mapped out. They protest it and they win the protest because you didn't do this little piece right. It can be frustrating because none of the three deciders in the government, the economic decider, the contracting officer, and the user, none of them own the process. None of them at the end of the day can say, just buy it. Whereas on the B2B side, if you start at the top and it's a $5 million a business and the owner says, we'll just buy this, it's decided. Like he can trump everything. Whereas with the B2G, as much as I want to give you a contract, there might be some law that says you just can't, or the path to do it is going to take 2 months. And we didn't plan for that in the schedule. So,
well, and that's what's interesting is because I could totally imagine the frustration of a business development, sales, whatever you want to call it, on the person who's trying to go B2G, is where they're just used to being able to persuade and overcome any objections to get that sale closed in the private sector, right? Like, okay, I want to sell to Amazon. I'll just keep working on this until I get Jeff Bezos to agree or enough people to agree. And then we're done, right? And I can understand how on the government side, you can't. I mean, there's obstacles with that procurement process and whatever's going on with the contracting officer. You might be able to overcome, or you will be able to overcome them eventually, but you can't persuade or convince your way into a government contract like you would in the other space. And it's interesting because I'm thinking about my dad who worked for nonprofit research and engineering company that basically most of their stuff was government contractor, a lot DOD. And he would constantly tell me stories of like, okay, we need this part. Well, on this contract, we can't get this part from this company because they get their source materials from this foreign country. And because of that, we can't buy their part. And now we can't do it. And now it's going to cost 100 times more because I have to have somebody custom make them. And so I heard those stories forever. So it makes total sense.
Yeah. I had one where I think it was platinum. There was a little piece of platinum. It was a weapon that had to be smelted in the US. And it happened to be that it was actually smelted in one of those countries that we don't want to buy stuff from. And it was a debacle, to say the least. I mean, it's a big deal. And that kind of stuff, you have to be ready for it. I mean, one of the many values is consistency. Once you learn where these risk points are for your type of business and your type of sale, they're going to be pretty common across agencies. Things like wide area workflow is pretty much how the government, the Defense Department, pays every contractor. So whether your contract is with the Air Force or with some niche agency inside of DISA or something, it's the same process to get paid, right? It's the same FAR they're living off. It's the same supplements they're living off in under the FAR. They've all got their own rules. But the idea of consistency, whereas that's something I learned when I started selling to businesses, they're all different. Even the ones that do the same thing in the same market and they're both publicly traded, that they've got their own process. And it could change a week based on somebody's attitude. So yeah, it's very different.
How much does the human factor fit into decision-making? I know there's the rules in the process once it comes to the contracting officer, but even they have the ability. Like how much is that rapport, the relationships? How much of that translates from any other sale into B2G?
I'd say it's close. It's going to be similar to being B2B, just because if you have a relationship, the government will tell you what the process is so you can be prepared for it. So that's a big part of it. Another thing is that think of the acquisition, the federal acquisition regulation. It's like a Plinko board. It's like a choose your own adventure, right? One of the questions we get is that, well, you're a contracting officer. How would you buy software? I can think of 10 ways off the top of my head that I could buy software. And so that's the human factor. And it's frankly why I've been in this industry for good grief, 25 years. It's fascinating because every time you think you know the way, there's another way to do it. Or there was always 5 ways. You just found your way to do it. And that's part of the process, is figuring out if this agency always buys all of their IT products from the NASA SEWP contract, which stands for Enterprise-Wide Procurement, I think is what the SEWP, but it's this giant contract that NASA manages that you can buy pretty much anything under the sun for IT from. But anybody, including NASA, I mean, lots of other agencies can use it. There's, I think, like 2,000 companies that are on this contract. But if the agency you're trying to sell to historically buys from them, that's a way. There's lots of other ways they could buy from you. And that's where the relationship part comes from, and understanding what those options could be. One of the questions that we often ask when we're helping companies kind of navigate their way into the space is, what do you want the acquisition strategy to be? And once you understand the importance of that question, you think, okay, well, I want the government to buy it this way. And then we can look at that and go, yeah, that's not going to happen. Or I want them to buy it this way or this way. I'm like, you know what? Those are both possible. Let's see how they've done it in the past. Or let's see what we can do to influence them buying it that way. And it could be things like, we win more contracts when there's an ISO 9000 certification required in the contract. Well, that, again, now we're getting into the shaping, right? When you can shape the acquisition to say, based on history, this is important to have an ISO 9000. Again, you're not the only company that has that. So you're not making the case that you have to sole source it to me, but you're creating an advantage. And you show that to the user and he says, you know what? I want you to have processes if you're building my stuff. And poof, it gets added in there. Now you've boxed out all the companies that don't have the ISO certification. And the same kind of stuff happens when you're doing a B2B sale, is understand what your competitive advantage is and shape to it. And so that's where the nuance comes in, like going back to the question of what is the human element of this? And it's how we navigate through the FAR. Now, full disclosure, the lower the dollar amount, the less human navigation there's going to be. And that's why for small companies, that simplified acquisition procedures, that's a really good spot to be, because there's a lot of nuance within that. They can do a $5 million commercial contract that only three companies bid on. The structure of that contract, how long it is, how many contract line items there are, what requirements are going to be in that whole contract versus attachments to other contracts. All of those are decisions made by a person. That person might be a contracting officer, might be the user. It's usually not the economic decider, by the way. The thing about the economic decider, that's the general that's in charge. They very rarely are going to be making the decision on what happens at the contract level. And so the best way to describe the relationship with somebody at that level is like a lot of people will hire some retired general and pay them $25,000 a month to get them into an agency. That's effective if your long-term strategy is to know what the agency, their mission and vision is. You'll get that. But to get the contract level strategy of what kind of contracts do they award, what kind of companies did they award them to, all that stuff's available for free at usaspending.gov. So go there first and get some business intelligence before you go hire somebody to get you in the top door. Because the distance from the top floor of a government agency to where the contracts get done might be a few stories. It might be 50 stories. You could waste a lot of time doing it wrong.
And I could totally see that, right? I mean, obviously you need that general who, A, has the budget, knows that they want to spend it, whoever the end user is telling them that this makes sense, right? And that it's worth the money, but they're flying at a much higher elevation over
Correct.
The battlefield, whether it's an actual battlefield or not. And so that's all interesting. And there's something you said earlier I just wanted to point out too, which is that if you are a startup and you're new and you have something that's innovative, your success in a B2B stance or situation is your effectiveness at finding other early adopters who are willing Correct. To take a chance on something that's innovative and brand new. And so when you look at a sales kind of market for an innovative, new, never before heard of solution, you're looking for those people on the left of the bell curve that are the early adopters who are like, this sounds great, let's give it a shot. Everybody else, like the middle of the bell curve, aren't going to take a chance on it until you have that proof. And so that's usually what it takes. And what you're talking about is government is middle or end of the bell curve, which is like, we are definitely not taking a chance. If it's something groundbreaking and we've never heard of before, like, no.
For the most part, the amount of times you're going to be able to get a first adopter on the government side, you have to know what niche you're in. And just as a taxpayer and as a fan of understanding the government's not like inept at this, they do have processes for it. So there's this thing called the SBIR program, which stands for Small Business Innovation Research. And the idea is this is new ideas. And so the government puts out a solicitation, it's an announcement. They also call them broad agency announcements, where they'll say, we want you to help us make our vehicles lighter. Go. And then you submit white papers effectively. They're not formal proposals. They're ideas to say, well, you could do this, this, and this, and this. And the government says, you know what? That's a cool idea. And they'll give you like $100,000 to test it and see will this actually work. So there are avenues to do, like the government does get a lot of innovative stuff, but it's its own process. And like the stuff you're seeing on beta.sam.gov, which is the site where all the opportunities are. If you look on there, for a solution that you could do better with your new innovative product that nobody's ever bought before, it's not going to work. The SBIR program is where you should be going. And by the way, the SBIR program is for businesses with US-based businesses with under 500 employees. So you don't have to be tiny. We have actually a whole podcast episode about that. because it's a really cool way that the government gets really innovative stuff.
Got it. I love it. So let's shift gears just a little bit here into some of the standard stuff that I love talking about and having guests talk about. And now I'm just super curious, both on your perspective experience, but then on the B2G side specifically, is what does authenticity mean to you? And then as a further on, because this is so fascinating, where does that play into these B2G sales?
Authenticity is evidence. Is what evidence can I see that you're being who you say you are? I love that term because the marketing world can spin so much and things don't look authentic. And so I want to be able to see, is this who you really are, right? So that's how it hits me, whether it's I'm interviewing people or for that matter, I'm talking to prospects or even bringing on team members or keeping the customers that we have. I'm looking for authenticity. On the B2G side, the best way to describe authenticity, again, we're back to evidence, is past performance. Is documenting your past performance, whether it's your commercial past performance, your past performance as an individual who's done this work before, or even better, the best kind. We actually did a whole episode about the types of value of past performance. The best past performance is work you've done as a company. Like, what has your company done? Again, this can be commercial past performance. Again, best case scenario is if it's government past performance. But authenticity, what hits as soon as you say that word in the government world is, show me you've done this before. Show me that you can actually get the work done. Because as a contracting officer, my win is awarding a contract that works. Because again, I'm not the one with the requirement. I'm not the one with the money. My job is to connect industry with the person that's got the need and the person that's got the money, is to make that thing flow. Well, the way that I know you have authenticity is your past performance. And the evidence, whether it's on your website, I'll give you an example. There's this thing called the Contractor Performance Assessment Reporting System. It's a mouthful. CPARS, right? Because the government's got to make an acronym. Well, to be fair, lots of organizations make acronyms, yes, but everyone. Government's got plenty of them. But so the CPARS system, it's kind of like your credit score as a government contract. And so a contracts that are worth over $1 million, there has to be a CPARS report on them once a year. And basically you score between unsatisfactory, it was a train wreck, all the way up to exceptional. And there's 5 layers. You want to be somewhere in the middle to the top, right? That's your authenticity. If you have lots of CPARS reports and they're all excellent or outstanding, that's evidence that you authentically are a government contractor, okay? If you're an existing contractor. So let's back this up to those people who aren't. Now we're into what's called being a responsible contractor. So what evidence do I have as a contracting officer that you are a responsible contractor? You'll be able to deliver this. This is an entire section, it's a subsection of the FAR about the definition of a responsible contractor. We did a whole podcast episode about that topic. Because I'm responsible as a contracting officer to only award, and I'm going from memory in the FAR, only award contracts to contractors who are responsible and perform with ethical, who can perform ethically. So this idea of it's my butt if I sign a contract to the wrong company.
Right.
And so this authenticity, and that's why, that's a lot of the reason contracting officers are non-responsive. We don't answer the phone. We don't email you back. We don't just give contracts to anybody because we're afraid that we're going to end up in the news as the guy that awarded the contract to the scumball down the street. Like, that's our fear. It's a little bit of a fear-based profession, unfortunately, from that perspective. But awareness of that will help you a lot. But this idea of what evidence do I have that you are responsible? And again, the best way for me to see that is going to be past performance. So if you've been in business for 10 years and you've just never sold to the government, or if you have lots of testimonials from your commercial customers showing that you do something that the commercial industry wants, as well as government, like painting, grounds maintenance, cybersecurity, like, both government and industry need those things. So there's lots of stuff that you can say, here's all my evidence that I've done this, that I'm an authentic business, and you can trust me after you give me a contract. That's how I would really focus your marketing to government folks.
I love it. And I've never heard that word before, but it seems to be just perfect summation of it, which is evidence, which I've had people who say consistency and seeing that you're the same, but that evidence, which is the consistency, is I just want to see that evidence. I just want to see what you say is what you do.
Right.
And if you're in alignment, and that's fantastic. That's amazing. The other half of the equation for me is the persuasion piece, right? So what do you think about when you hear the word persuasion? And then where does persuasion fit into the B2G formula?
For me, the persuasion is why you. Like, I get that I need this and I get that I might be gonna buy it from somebody, but why am I buying it from you? Right. And the cool part from the persuasion piece on the government side, there are 3 basic elements of every proposal, and I'll zoom out to the bigger ones. You've got past performance, technical, and price. And so the persuasion is going to fall mostly in the technical, which is how are you going to do this? And then a close second behind that is gonna be past performance. And so if you look at a lot of government RFPs, they'll be broken into those buckets. And usually they're ordered by technical, past performance, and price. Sometimes price is most important, but oftentimes, given all things being equal, like everybody else, they'll take lower price. But people will say government always buys the lowest price. It's inherently not true. What they actually do is they get all the other people who could do it out of the way and find the ones who actually are able to do it, then pick the lowest price. If you think in terms of it as a two-step approach, so what you want to focus on finding those agencies that appreciate what you can do, which that's a technical, and how well you can explain to them that you can do it. You got to be able to show them how are you going to provide cybersecurity that is proactive versus reactive. Because anybody can just go in and tell you, oh, I'll clean the mess up after it happens. Well, the best cybersecurity actually is looking for people trying to break in the first place, right? That's an example of how do you persuade them you meet that technical requirement? And then, of course, the backup to that is show me you've done it before. Or back to that evidence. Is the best way to persuade me that why are you the right one to do this, is take that evidence piece. And that's why they fit really well together. Is if you have authenticity, you're halfway to persuasion. But if you don't have authenticity, you're just trying to sell me something I don't want. Or you're trying to convince me you can do something I don't think you can do. So start with authenticity before you even get into persuasion.
I love it.
I just made that up.
It's almost like I set you up for that, even though I didn't. That was perfect. So one question I ask everybody on the show, and I'm super curious for you. I'm going to guess contracting officer wizard of the world was not your plan as a kid. What did you want to be when you were growing up?
Baseball player, of course, like every little kid. But actually, I liked creating. My degree is in art, English, and German. And I added all the business stuff afterwards. But I'm one of the few contracting officers that I'm probably 60% creative and 40% pragmatic. And most contracting officers are the other way around. And so I didn't see that building into being a contracting officer is something that I would necessarily pick up. But when I actually interviewed for the job and they told me it was a lot of puzzle solving, I mean, you're part attorney, you're part negotiator, you're part wizard of the far. Like, you have to figure out how we're going to buy this. And then you got to decide how. And so it's the creativity of what path can I take? Of all the paths that I can go through on this one, which one makes the most sense? So I didn't see that coming, but it's funny that one of the things I advise to our, we have a lot of listeners that are government too. And I tell them one of the things you can do to make yourself a better contracting officer is take sales training. Because part of what we do is we're selling our acquisition strategy, our how we're going to buy this to the user. Because the user just wants to, it's like, can I just go down and buy this from this company? I want it now. And the economic decider says, just get the money obligated so that this task is done. But I have to sell them on the idea of, here's why we're going to take 2 months to figure out who's the right fit for this. Here's why we're going to put out a request for information to get feedback from industry and figure out how they can actually do it. And so that creativity piece is probably the most important part. So I would say if I had to pick something back when I was a kid, it was doing something creative. I mean, I thought I would be an artist. I thought I'd be a translator. But yeah, what it came down to is I like solving puzzles. And it turns out that government contracting and sales are full of puzzles.
Well, as soon as you said that, especially about the degrees, that's all I could think about was the creativity that I see as a vital tool of a professional salesperson who's very effective, because it's creative. It's like, how do I figure out what your problem is? And then how do I solve your problem in a way that helps everybody, helps you win? And then you add in the government piece, which takes a lot of creativity, and just anything of solving any problem. That's amazing. What is your definition of success?
Personally or professionally?
You can answer it both ways.
Personally, this is going to sound trite, but fulfillment is what you got done worth doing to you and to somebody else? That's the whole, are you compounding? Are you a compounding factor in the world? And yes, we could, the easiest metric is revenue, but the other metric is impact. It's number of people that you've actually helped. It's number of people that use your content. Like, are you compounding the world? And so the way that I define that is fulfillment, because one of the things I do every day is, how are you multiplying your time? And I got to do, like, we're multiplying our time right now. We're creating a piece of content that will be listened to an infinite number of times. And that's a compounding value. And so that's how I define fulfillment. And then from a professional side of how I define success is, there's some actually from Andy Stanley. I got to give him credit for this one. And his podcast, he said, the definition of leadership is getting things done through other people. And so when I look at my organization or I say my because I've started it, but it's really, I'm working with everybody. Are we getting more done now than we were last year? And if we are, and I'm not working 100 hours a week, I'm still only working 60, then we're succeeding. We're getting more done with the same number of people, or we're getting exponentially more done with more people. But it's that whole idea of success for me from a professional perspective is multiplying your efforts to create more impact. And the easiest metric for that is, are you getting more done and not working more? Because you can't just work more. You can't just work. I'll just work 100 hours a week forever. Yeah, good luck.
Yeah, doesn't work. You can't sustain it. Sprints, yes. Long-term, no. So then the final question I have here is, which is more important, or which do you think is your focus, the journey or the destination? But let's spin it a little bit and look at your definition of success personally or in the business. Where does the journey and the destination fit into that success path?
Well, it has to be journey, because fulfillment's a day-to-day thing. You're not going to get to your destination today. One of my metrics is, did I do something to multiply my time, right? Well, I'm going to do that every day. And I don't know where that's necessarily going to take us. We have a vision for what we're trying to do. We're trying to help make government contracting better, one contract at a time. That's the mission of Skyway. We're never going to get there. If it were the destination, how am I going to know I got there? So it's much more about the journey to me, and the idea of, what are the things that I can do now that are going to expand how quickly we reach that destination we're never going to get to. If you're back to the puzzle solving, it's like, I'm never going to be an expert in sales, but I'm going to get better every single day and help other people get there too.
I love it. That's fantastic. So for people who are interested to learn more about what you do and your company, the podcast, so the best websites for people is if they go to skywayacq.com. So
correct.
Skyway Acquisitions, skywayacq.com. And then also you have askskyway.com. So those are
correct.
Good sites for you. And then so everyone, you mentioned it several times, which I'm super happy. And I love very niche podcasts that serve a great audience who are interested, and from both sides of the fence, if you will, the government
right.
and the people wanting to serve to the government. So the podcast is called the Contracting Officer Podcast. Obviously, they can find it everywhere. They can also go to govconpodcast.com to find that info. I know that we've connected through LinkedIn. What's best social media platform for people as well?
Yeah, LinkedIn by far. And it's Jans, J-A-N-S. And if you look up, Skyway is actually named after the bridge that goes over Tampa Bay, the Sunshine Skyway Bridge. That's what we're named after. And so if you Google Skyway Acquisition, you'll find us all over LinkedIn. In fact, we put out a podcast episode almost every day. We're not quite as prolific as you. We have 325 and we update content because people, they love being able to get the niche perspective, a couple of contracting officers, about this puzzle of GovCon.
Well, I know that I have another podcast season break coming up in me, so it'll give you a chance to catch up for sure. Kevin,
awesome.
Thanks for coming on here. Thanks for sharing everything from how the B2C journey goes to B2G, how this part works. Hopefully it was some great info. Please, audience, make sure to connect up with Kevin if you're interested in any of that and see what he's doing. Kevin, thanks again for being here and sharing all this. Truly awesome. I loved it.
Thanks, Jason, for the invite. This was a lot of fun. I enjoyed talking with you.
Thanks for tuning into the Authentic Persuasion Show. If you found value in this episode, please do two things. Subscribe so you can get each new episode, and share this episode with anyone else you know in sales. Together, we can help shift the way sales is done. And if you want to find out more information about how to transform your sales career, or you want help with shifting your sales team from order takers to quota breakers, go to jasoncutter.com. Don't forget that everything in life is sales, and I will catch you on the next episode of the Authentic Persuasion Show.